This podcast is sponsored by Ramp. Are you the decision maker in your company? Consider this. For the first time in decades, there's a better option for a corporate card and spend management platform. Meet Ramp, the only corporate card and spend management system designed to help you spend less money so you can make more. Most corporate credit cards offer points as incentives, but those points amount to less than their worth in real cash value. Ramp's business cards offer you cash back, real money in your pocket. Plus, you control who spends what with each vendor. And Ramp software collects and verifies receipts automatically, which means you'll stop wasteful spending and close your books in hours instead of days. Businesses that use Ramp add up to 5% to their bottom line the first year. If you're a decision maker, adding Ramp could be one of the best decisions you've ever made. And now get $250 when you join Ramp for free. Just go to ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy.
Cards issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members of FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
You're listening to Working, the podcast about what people do all day. I'm Jacob Brogan. This season on Working, we're talking to individuals whose jobs touch on aspects of LGBTQ life. Not everyone who's trans chooses to have gender reassignment surgery, but many of those who do want that surgery are unable to have the procedures they desire. Sometimes that's for insurance reasons, and sometimes it's because there just aren't enough surgeons to go around. For this week's episode, we talk to someone who's trying to change some of that. Dr. Jess Ting is a gender reassignment surgeon at Mount Sinai Hospital's Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery. He's also working to train a new generation of surgeons through the hospital's fellowship program. Among other things, in this episode, he tells us a little about how he ended up working in this area and talks about the procedures that he's helped pioneer. By way of warning, I should also say that there are some pretty graphic descriptions of surgery in this episode, so if you're squeamish, this may not be the one for you, but we think it's super interesting and important. Then in a Slate Plus Extra, Dr. Ting talks about what his kids think of his work on gender reassignment surgery. If you're a member, enjoy bonus segments and interview transcripts from Working, plus other great podcast exclusives. Start your 2-week free trial at slate.com/workingplus. What is your name and what do you do?
My name is Jess Ting and I am a plastic surgeon that specializes in transgender surgery.
What does that entail exactly? What kind of surgeries do you conduct? What kind of surgeries do you specialize in?
Well, say today, for example, I did a gender reassignment surgery. Mm-hmm. And all of the surgeries that I do right now consist of gender-affirming surgeries where we take someone from one physical state, a gender which they were assigned at birth, and convert their physical state to a gender which is more in line with their internal gender identity. So say you were assigned male at birth, but you are female internally. So we can take your physical body and make you a female.
We'll get into the details of your day in a minute, I think, but can you say a little now what these surgeries actually involve, practically speaking? What are you doing with the bodies of the patients that you work with?
So we work in either direction. Say if you're a trans woman, you were assigned male at birth and you have male genitalia, you have a penis and scrotum, and we can take those male parts and make them into female parts. So we take a penis and scrotum and make that into a vagina and clitoris.
Mm-hmm. And how many of these surgeries do you conduct a year?
Well, we just had a meeting this morning. We have these monthly meetings, and they told me that we have done 350 surgeries since March of 2016.
And that's at Mount Sinai, where you work?
That is at Mount Sinai Hospital, where I work.
So how did you end up at a point in your career where you were working on transgender health issues specifically? I'm guessing that that's not what you were originally trained primarily to do, right?
No. And to be perfectly honest, when we started this program at the end of 2015, I had never really even met a transgender person. I didn't even know what that meant. And I was a plastic surgeon. I had a busy practice consisting of mostly breast reconstruction after mastectomy for breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And Mount Sinai, for a variety of reasons that we can talk about later, decided to start the first transgender surgery program in New York City. So if you can believe it, in a city this large with this many people, there was no place where you could have gender-affirming bottom surgery.
So what kind of – did you have to retrain yourself? Did you have to rethink the sort of background that you had in order to start conducting these sort of surgeries?
Yeah, it was pretty daunting because these surgeries are – they're unlike any others. And like the surgery I did today, it's a vaginoplasty. It's a combination of OBGYN, urology, plastic surgery. It's really a unique meshing of – techniques from different specialties that just doesn't exist in any other field of surgery. So mm-hmm. when we decided to do this, I had to go back and relearn. And that involved traveling around the world to learn from the handful of people who do these operations.
How many folks are there doing these sorts of surgeries around the world today? Do you have a sense of those kind of figures?
Well, the bottom surgery, the genital reassignment surgery, I would say there may be 20 to 30.
Around the world?
Around the world. Now, that number wow. is exploding because, as you know, there's a tremendous increase in the interest, tremendous increase in the number of programs and the number of people who are seeking surgery and in the number mm-hmm. of medical centers around the world that are trying to do these operations.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you said that when you first got into this that you had a little sense of what trans life, trans experience entailed. Has that changed? I mean, did you have to sort of delve into that world, that discourse, as you started training yourself toward being able to work on these issues?
Yeah, so absolutely. Besides learning the techniques, the technology, the medicine, and the surgery, you know, I had to become educated in the culture, the cultural sensitivity. Learning to ask someone, what is your preferred gender? What is your preferred name? Mm-hmm. And it's been life-changing.
Yeah. And one thing that I think is probably critically important is that different individuals, of course, have – different trans individuals, of course, have different relationships to the process of transitioning. Surgery, you know, is not the – singular endpoint for everyone who identifies as trans. As you are working with patients, and in fact, probably as you were learning about this whole discourse, do you find yourself having conversations with people about their different experiences of the process of transitioning?
Yeah. So, I mean, as you say, and that's a very good observation, not every transgender patient wants to transition surgically. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's great diversity in what patients want. So I've learned to just listen, follow the lead of the patient and ask them, what do they want? What is their mm-hmm. transition?
What are some of the options that Mount Sinai can provide to those folks who are finding other ways to embrace their gender identity?
Right. So we have a multi-specialty center. For some patients, transitioning is just taking hormones. Mm-hmm. And we have endocrinologists, primary care doctors who can support a patient through that sort of transition. For other patients, a transition is just a name change or a gender marker change on their driver's license. And mm-hmm. we have social workers who can help patients navigate the labyrinthian things that they have to go through to get that accomplished.
That's great. The procedures that you conduct when you do conduct these surgeries, are they things that are clearly established in medical literature, or have you had to work things out on your own as you've kind of delved into this line of practice?
One of the incredible things about this specialty is that it's a very young specialty. Mm-hmm. And the operations that we do are new and they're unrefined, they're undeveloped. And one of the remarkable things is only a year and a half into this whole new specialty, we've already, number one, I've invented a whole new way of doing a female-to-male phalloplasty. I've developed new techniques for doing vaginoplasties. It's a unique opportunity to be doing a specialty which is so undeveloped, to be entering the field really in its infancy. The opportunities for innovation and pushing the envelope in terms of what we can do with the technology that we have.
Can you say more about techniques that you've developed? What have you done on that front?
Well, say, for example, in a vaginoplasty, we're creating a vagina. And if you think about a biological vagina, it's smooth, it's moist, it's secretory, whereas the most common operation that we do today for creating a vagina is we create a vagina which is lined with skin. Hmm. It's dry. It can grow hair. It's really not very close to a biological vagina. And about a year ago, a patient came to me and said, well, Dr. Ting, you know, there's this paper in India where they have this technique where they take peritoneum, which is a lining from the inside of the abdomen. And it's a unique tissue because it's smooth, it's hairless, it's secretory. In many ways, it's very similar to a vagina. And the patient was like, well, can you make a vagina out of this? And, you know, I read the paper, I brought it home, and the exact technique that they had used would not apply in our patients. But, you know, I kept thinking about it for the next several weeks, and I came up with this adaptation of that technique where we could take the peritoneum, harvest it laparoscopically, remove it from the body, and then reinsert it through the vagina to create a vagina which is much more similar to a biological female's vagina by using this tissue, this peritoneum. So now we can create a vagina which is smooth, it's secretory, it's self-lubricating, just much more similar to a biological vagina.
That must be really exciting to be able to kind of shake up or push forward this surgical field that is so important to so many people.
Well, it's really cool. I mean, it's terrifying on the one hand because we're pushing the envelope, but I mean, the existing operations, I mean, they're not there yet. So the need is there to create better operations.
You've only been doing this for a few years, but do you find that the medical discourse is changing? Is there communication between surgeons, between people who are trying to move these techniques forward, or is it, you know, sort of everyone for themselves at this point?
Absolutely. So transgender surgery used to be a specialty that lived sort of on the margins of the medical world. There were no large medical centers that would allow transgender surgery to happen within their hospitals. So you would find a surgeon here or there, usually operating in a small community hospital. One of the pioneers operated in a tiny town in Colorado. And, you know, 10, 15 years ago, people operated in these little silos. They were isolated, operating by themselves, and people were very proprietary and protective of their techniques. No one shared. There was no open discourse. And as this has moved into the mainstream, that has changed. There are more conferences, there are societies. There's a much more open exchange of ideas. And one of the things that we've done at Mount Sinai is we've created the first fellowship in transgender surgery, and something like that didn't even exist. Like up until July of 2017, there was no place in the United States where a doctor could go and formally learn how to do these operations.
So that means, in effect, that you're training the next generation of surgeons who will work on these issues.
Absolutely. I mean, it's ironic, right? Because I'm a beginner myself. I've only started doing this a year ago, and yet here we are training the next generation. But there's just such
you've got to learn by doing.
You've got to learn by, you know, there's an expression in medicine, see one, do one, teach one.
Yeah.
But what we found very shortly after opening our program is that there is a tremendous unmet need for surgeons, for doctors to take care of transgender patients. And a year and a half in, we have a waiting list that numbers in the hundreds.
How did this project at Mount Sinai begin in the first place? What was its genesis?
It was really a coincidence of sorts. There was a transgender medical program at St. Vincent's Hospital. There was one at Beth Israel Hospital. And those used to be separate standalone hospitals. At one point, Beth Israel acquired St. Vincent's, and then Mount Sinai acquired Beth Israel. So here we are. We've inherited this large primary care practice of transgender patients. And there's a woman named Barbara Warren, who's director of diversity and inclusion at Mount Sinai. And she was very involved in the program as and she came to the board of directors, the board of trustees of Mount Sinai High, and gave a presentation on the transgender practice. And our CEO, Ken Davis, decided there on the spot that Mount Sinai would take a leadership position and start the first transgender surgery program in New York City.
And how did you become involved?
Well, Ken Davis asked our hospital president, Dave Rich, to get this program rolling. And I had worked with Dave Rich on a number of other programs in the past. And so he came to me and said, listen, you know, you're a plastic surgeon and we need a plastic surgeon to start this program.
At that point, no background, no experience with this specific surgical field. You're just ready to go. Was it close enough to what you'd been doing before that you felt comfortable, or was that scary?
It was scary. I'd had a little bit of exposure to this in residency, but not very much. And, you know, I was at a point in my career where, you know, I was looking for the next challenge. And, you know, to be able to start on the ground floor and start the first program in a city like New York and to serve an unmet need for so many people, that was just an opportunity I couldn't pass up.
Absolutely. So is there such a thing as a typical day for you these days since you've started this program, this project?
Well, today is a pretty typical day.
Okay. How did it go?
Today was an awesome day. I got up at 6. At 7:30, I was in the operating room, and we were doing a male-to-female gender reassignment surgery on a 30-year-old transgender female.
Is that typical that you're there 7:30 in the morning getting going?
It is. Monday, I now do 4 days of surgery, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. We start at 7:30 on each of those days.
Is there a reason that surgeries are scheduled for those hours of the morning?
Well, there are only so many hours in the day, and we want to help as many patients as we can. So we start at 7:30, and we try to do 2 surgeries a day or 1 surgery and then seeing patients in the afternoon.
So today you did that 1 surgery in the morning, and then what came after that?
So today I did that surgery. We started at 7:30. I was done by 12:30. And then at 1 o'clock I started seeing patients in the office. Mm-hmm. And that means seeing patients who are coming to us before surgery and patients who are coming to us after surgery. It's a mix.
And so is there kind of generally, is there a balance of the time that you spend consulting with patients and the time you spend in surgery? Is it like 50-50 or somewhere in that range?
Yeah. So probably I spend about 70% of my time in the operating room, because that's something that, I mean, no one else can do right now aside from me. So I try and maximize the number of patients that we operate on. Mm-hmm. And we have help in the office. I have a physician assistant. We have residents who can help me see more patients. And the idea is to get through our waiting list. We have a waiting list of 300 or 400 patients. So the faster we can get those patients ready for surgery and the more time that we're operating, the more we can take care of patients who have been waiting for decades sometimes for surgery.
Yeah. But I assume that I mean, especially with a relatively small staff, with you as the only kind of operating physician, if I'm understanding right, that there are just limits to how much you can actually do in a given day at this point.
There are absolutely limits that I am finding.
Yeah. I mean, would it be possible to do 3-4 surgeries in a day, or would that just be beyond the limits of the human body?
There might be someone who could do 3 or 4 surgeries a day, but not me. And, you know, these operations, they're really huge operations. They're daunting. They're scary. I mean, you're operating in very critical structures and, you know, the margin for error is very small.
Yeah.
You have to focus. You have to be on your game. And, you know, you're changing people's lives, so it has to be perfect every time.
What are the initial consultations like? When you first sit down with a new patient, someone who might be considering surgery, what sort of conversation are you having from the get-go?
Well, the first priority is we want to do safe surgery. Mm-hmm. And we want to make sure our patients are ready for surgery emotionally, mentally. We want to make sure they're physically prepared for surgery. And we want to make sure that socially they're well prepared to cope with the post-operative course, that they're living in some place that's safe, that they have people who can help them after surgery, that they have a plan for recovery. Before we do surgery, we need to make sure that the patients are adequately prepared, that they know what they're getting themselves into. This is a big commitment. It's a big step. Yeah, we follow the WPATH guidelines.
What are those?
Right. The WPATH is the World Professional Organization of Transgender Health Professionals. Mm-hmm. And essentially, anyone who wants gender reassignment surgery has to be living in the desired gender for a year. They have to be on hormones for a year, and they need letters from two mental health professionals stating that they are ready for surgery.
Mm-hmm. Do you communicate with other professionals, with doctors who've seen them in the past, or do you just rely on those letters, that kind of information that they're bringing to you?
Right, yeah. So one of the advantages of working at Mount Sinai is that we have a multi-specialty center. Mm-hmm. It's the CTMS, the Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery. And at our center, we have psychiatrists, psychologists, primary care doctors, endocrinologists, mental health professionals, and every patient that has bottom surgery at our program is screened by this multidisciplinary panel. Every week we sit down in a conference room with about 10 other doctors, social workers, psychiatrists, and we talk about every patient, and we make sure that every patient is fully prepared for surgery. Mm-hmm. And once they've passed that screening process, then and only then do they get an appointment to see me for surgery.
Okay. So they've been through a lot before they come, this really kind of holistic program before they come to you.
Exactly. They've been through a lot.
Are there ever folks who are coming from outside the Mount Sinai system, or is your work entirely focused on internal treatment through that program?
We operate primarily on patients in the New York City area, mm-hmm. and not just within Mount Sinai, but anywhere within 100 miles of New York City. But, you know, as our reputation has grown, we are getting referrals and inquiries from all over the world. Like just last week, we had emails from Australia, Japan, Europe, South America.
So after a potential patient has been through this whole process with other physicians, other medical care professionals, when you first sit down with them, what are you trying to learn or discover? I mean, what do you need to know from them in order to do the best possible work?
So when I meet a patient for the first time, you know, I generally meet them just once before surgery. And I just want to try and get a sense for who they are and what they want from surgery. And I want to make sure that their expectations are reasonable, that their expectations are in line with what I can provide them. Mm-hmm. Because the goal is to have happy patients.
Of course, yeah. If you ever do get an inclination, if you ever get an inkling that the patient's expectations are not in line with what you can provide, is that something that you communicate there? Do you have some other way of trying to take a step back?
Or? Absolutely. And, you know, this has happened. I have come across patients who I felt were not realistic in what they wanted, what they thought they could have from surgery. Mm-hmm. And I'll just turn around and refer those patients back to the center and have them reevaluated. I'll spend time talking to them. The last thing we want to do is operate on someone who, you know, we can't give them what they expect.
What other kinds of information do you convey in those meetings with patients?
It's important to talk about the risks of surgery and all the things that can go wrong. you know, we try to do safe surgery, but sometimes there are complications. There are things that we just can't control for. And it's important that patients go into these operations knowing what the possible risks are.
Sure. But that's true for any surgery, I assume, that you would ever conduct or have conducted
to
some extent.
Informed consent is part of every pre-surgical consultation.
Mm-hmm. And is there anything else that's important in those conversations?
Well, I want to make sure that the patient is emotionally and psychologically in a place where they're ready for surgery and where I think that they will have a good outcome, where they will be able to take care of themselves and after surgery.
Yeah. All right. So you've met with someone. It sounds like you're generally only going to meet with them once before surgery. How long is it between that initial meeting and the actual procedure typically?
Well, we have a pretty long wait list for surgery. So the patients, for example, that I saw today are getting booked for surgery in June of 2018.
Wow. It's a long time out.
It's a long time out. And that's with me operating at full capacity every day that I can possibly operate.
Do you ever have to grapple with the frustrations of patients about that kind of timetable?
Yeah, patients, you know, people want to be who they want to be. And for our patients, for some of our patients, having the surgery is the most important thing that they can do for themselves.
Hmm.
And yeah, if you have to wait a long time for surgery, it's tough. It's frustrating. And some of our patients have waited 30, 40 years for surgery.
Right. This isn't the first time they've been delayed.
This isn't the first time. Yeah, one of the cool things about what we're doing is we are allowing patients to have these surgeries who otherwise just would not be able to, who wouldn't have the resources to do so. And up until we started this program, there were no places in New York City where someone, say, who had Medicaid could have transition surgery.
Mm-hmm. That must be very gratifying to be contributing to that.
Yeah, it's really cool.
What sort of prep do you do in advance of surgery in the days or even hours before? What do you have to do to get ready to conduct one of these procedures?
I mean, it's like playing a football game, right? You have to get yourself mentally in the right place, make sure I have a good night's sleep. The operations are tough. Mm-hmm. They're not easy. You know, before I start every surgery, I'm always thinking about, okay, what are the 50 things that can go wrong in this operation? How do I make sure that none of those happen? I have to do every step perfectly, and I'm visualizing the different steps and what can go wrong and how do I do this? How do I make that better? How do I throw that stitch just the right way? A lot of it is mental preparation for me, visualization.
Hmm. So you do it all in your head before you do it?
I do it all in my head.
On the body.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It makes sense. Say a little prayer before every surgery.
And then 7:30 in the morning, you head into the surgical theater. Is that the right word? Into the surgery room?
Into the operating room. Yeah.
Into the operating room. That's it. And can you lead us through that experience? I mean, the patient, when they show up, are they already anesthetized or are they already under? Usually?
No. The patients come in and they walk into the holding area and we're there and we talk to them. We go over what they're going to have done. We double check that, you know, nothing has changed, that they're still ready to proceed with surgery, that they're mentally and emotionally in the right place for surgery. Mm-hmm. We go over the consent again. We talk about the exact surgical plan, what can go wrong, what we're going to do that day in surgery. And then we have them sign all the proper consents.
Mm-hmm.
Then the nurses come by, the anesthesiologists come by, and everyone has their role to play. We bring the patient to the operating room, start an intravenous line, and slowly just put them to sleep.
I imagine that there must often be some heightened emotions in that time just before surgery begins when you're having those conversations. Do you have to be attentive to your bedside manner in advance of a surgery?
Yeah. You know, for patients, it's a very emotional time. Many of them have waited a long time and they're nervous, they're terrified, but at the same time, really excited to start this new phase in their lives.
Mm-hmm. So once they've gone under, what's next? Who's in the in the operating room with you, first of all?
So there's an anesthesiologist. There's a scrub nurse. That's someone who hands me all my instruments and all the equipment that I need. There's another nurse, a circulating nurse, who will travel around the room and gather up anything that we need. And then I'll have someone helping me, either a resident or a fellow. That's a surgeon in training, or sometimes a physician assistant or a medical student.
Mm-hmm. And what is the process involved for example, for one of these vaginoplasties that you described earlier that you helped create this process? What are you doing there when you're actually in the operating room?
So, I mean, the first thing we do after we get the patient positioned on the operating room table is we take these magic markers and we sketch out exactly what we're going to do on the patient, on their skin. Hmm. And, you know, there's such a wide variety of anatomy from patient to patient. Everyone is different. So we really have to customize the surgical plan to each patient.
Mm-hmm. You've done some of that work, I assume, in advance of the actual surgery based on their chart, or is it all happening there in those hours?
I mean, when I see them in the office, I'll examine them and I already have an idea of what we're going to do. But it's not mm-hmm. until we're in the actual operating room that we draw on the patient and we sketch out the actual place where the incisions will be, where we're going to place the clitoris, where we'll place the vagina, mm-hmm. where we're going to be taking the skin graft from. All of that is done in real time in the operating room.
And how long does that part of the process take?
The sketching, the drawing takes about 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm. And where do you go from there? What's next?
And from there, at that point, we inject an anesthetic, a local anesthetic, a lidocaine, marcaine mixture all over the place where we operate. And I do that to minimize postoperative pain, right? The long-acting anesthetic that I inject will last for a couple of days, and that really helps minimize the pain in the first 24 hours after surgery.
Hmm.
And once that is done, we make our first incision, which is usually harvesting the skin. You know, we take the skin from the scrotum, cut it out in a butterfly incision shape, and that skin is used to make the deepest part of the vagina. So we'll take that skin mm-hmm. and prepare it by thinning it out, and then we save it on the back table, and we'll use it again at the end of the operation.
Hmm. And what comes after that?
So then in the next step, we do the orchiectomy, which is removal of the testes.
Uh-huh.
So through that same incision, we've removed the skin of the scrotum. So the two testes are there. We take them, we isolate them on their stalks, and we put these threads around the base of the stalk so they don't bleed, and we cut mm-hmm. them, and we remove each of the balls, and those get sent to a laboratory to be tested for any abnormalities.
Okay.
And then at that point, so in this operation, we take the skin of the penis, and essentially we turn it inside out and turn that into a vagina. It's like taking a sock and flipping it inside out. So before we can do that, we only want the skin. So we have to remove all the internal parts of the penis, the erectile parts, the urethra. Mm-hmm. So those are all removed meticulously, leaving just the skin. And, as part of that process, we save a little bit of the glands, the tip of the penis, to make a new clitoris from. We want to save the nerve and blood supply to that little bit of tissue. That's critically important. That becomes the new source of erogenous sensation in the female genitalia. Then we take that clitoris and we suture it to the pubic bone where a normal female clitoris would be. And then in the most dangerous part of the operation, we create the actual vaginal cavity, right? You need to create a space where there is none. And there's not a lot of room in the male pelvis to make that space. There's really only one place. And there's a narrow space between the rectum and the urethra. It's maybe a centimeter wide. And we have to open up that space with a scalpel and an electrical cautery about 8 inches deep without injuring either the rectum or the urethra to create a new vagina.
Wow.
And once we've created that space, then we take that skin, that sock, and we turn it inside out and place it into that space, and that becomes the new vagina.
How long does that part of the process take? That seems like it must be super involved, but I also assume you must have to work relatively quickly since you're dealing with issues of blood flow and things like this, right?
Right. The making of the vaginal pocket takes about 25 minutes, 30 minutes, and the whole operation takes about 4 hours.
Are there more steps to that you want to describe?
Well, then we shorten the urethra, right, so that the patient can urinate while sitting down. And aesthetically, we create a clitoral hood. We make the labia minora, make the labia majora. At that point, you know, it's a lot of aesthetics and artistry to just create the external genitalia.
Do you find yourself proud of the work that you do there? You describe it as artistry and aesthetic?
Yes, absolutely. We can make the most beautiful female genitalia.
Sure. That's great. The other kind of major surgery that you perform is phalloplasty, the correct term?
That's exactly it, yeah.
So you do these vaginoplasties and phalloplasty, which is presumably very different. Is it easier, harder, just different?
Phalloplasty is a much harder operation. And I mean, to be honest, the results are not nearly as good as the other way around. So we can make a very realistic, beautiful, and functional female vagina. Mm-hmm. But it's really hard, 2017, to make a phallus that is functional, that becomes erect, that has sensation, right? We can't really do all of those things today.
Because there's so many factors in play there, from distribution of nerve tissue, I assume, to the functioning of tumescence itself, which
exactly.
Is
exactly. You know, the erectile apparatus of the penis is unique in the human body, and there's nothing else like it.
Yeah.
The closest we can come, I mean, we can create the skin of a phallus, and we can create a reasonable facsimile, and maybe it will have some sensation. And then a year down the line, we can take an erectile apparatus. You know, it's like it's filled with water, and you can blow it up, and that can create an erection.
Mm-hmm. But that's a subsequent surgery that someone
would
have?
That's a subsequent surgery, and, you know, it has its own set of complications. It's not 100% successful. So clearly, the phalloplasty is an operation that's in need of improvement.
Once you've completed one of these surgical processes, are you immediately heading to another surgery typically, or do you have some downtime between them?
We immediately head into another operation. You know, we need time to get the dressing on, to wake the patient up, and they clean the room. They turn over the room, maybe about an hour between surgeries.
Mm-hmm. So you're sometimes looking at 10 hours of surgery in a given day then?
Yeah.
If I'm doing
give or
the math
take.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That must be pretty exhausting.
It's exhausting. And not even so much physically as it is just mentally exhausting.
Mm-hmm. What sort of follow-up do you do after a procedure? Do you see a patient later that evening, the next day? When do you check in with them?
We will check the patient usually the night of surgery, or one of our team members will go in and check on them, and then we see them the following day. And they're in the hospital for 3 or 4 days, depending on what the operation is. And then they go home, and after that, we see them back weekly for the first couple of months.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever had patients reconnect with you down the line, talk to you about how they've come away from it feeling, what their experience of life after surgery has been?
Yeah. So, you know, even after a 6 month or a year period of convalescence, I still see the patients every year for a checkup.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the cool things is getting to see the patients after they've transitioned, after they've had these surgeries, to see how it's affected their lives.
Mm-hmm. And what have you experienced of that? What have you seen from patients?
I mean, honestly, it's the most mind-blowing thing I've ever seen. And Like the oldest patient we've operated on was a 77-year-old trans woman. And the first time I saw her, she was like, well, Dr. Ting, I've waited since I was 5 years old to have this surgery. And, you know, when she first came in, she was really nervous. And she told me she wasn't sure that we were going to do her surgery because she was so old. She thought maybe we were going to tell her, you know what, you're too old to have surgery. And I think she was terrified of that. And when I told her, oh, absolutely, we're going to book you for surgery, I mean, she started crying. She was so happy. And so she had her surgery, and I'll never forget the first time she came in for her checkup and we removed the bandages and she got to see herself, she just burst into tears. So she's like, I've waited my whole life for this. I've waited my whole life to be who I am. Yeah, so that was pretty cool. I mean, and this is someone, she'd been living as a woman for many, many decades. She was married, had a stable life, but this was just something that she wanted to do for herself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's, I mean, it's striking that on the one hand, she was able to live as a woman, but this was a part of that that you were able to contribute to that she might not have been able to have at another moment in time.
Yeah, I think it was just one more step. There was one, it was just that one thing that always bothered her. Every day when she would look at her body, she would feel like, oh, this is not me. This is not who I am meant to be.
Hmm. Yeah. So you're also helping to train, as you said before, the next generation of gender reassignment surgeons through the fellowship program at Mount Sinai. What does that part of your job entail? What kind of education or training are you doing there?
So we started a fellowship in transgender surgery in July, and our first fellow, her name is Bella Avanesian. She finished plastic surgery training in June, and she's spending a year with us learning how to do these operations. Right now, she's on maternity leave. She just had a baby. But after she comes back, and what she did for the first several months of fellowship is essentially just shadow me. She was with me every day in surgery, seeing patients by my side, learning how to do every step of the operation, learning how to take care of patients before surgery, how to manage them after surgery.
Does that take any of the work off your hands, or are you still doing just as much as you would have been otherwise?
You know, in the beginning, it's probably more work. Because instead of just doing it, I also have to show it to someone else. But, I mean, she's an incredible surgeon, and she's learned very, very quickly.
And, that's great.
Yeah. She's taken on some of the tasks. She's made it easier. And the real payoff is next year. I'm hoping that she'll come back and join our faculty. And then we'll be able to operate on twice as many people.
That'd be great. And I'm sure many, many people would appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
So what's most rewarding about this work for you? What, you go to bed, I assume, exhausted every day. What are you feeling about your job as you're falling asleep, trying to get that good night's rest before the next morning surgeries?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I'd have to say there are just not that many jobs where you can get up in the morning and say, today I'm going to change someone's life. And that's the most rewarding part of what I get to do every day. I mean, it's a privilege and a joy.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about your work. I learned so much from this.
Thank you for having me.
It was totally our pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Working. I'm Jacob Brogan. This week, I also want to give a shout out to Slate's Audio Book Club, where you can listen in to monthly discussions of new and important books, guided usually by my friend Katie Waldman. Read the book club selections and then listen in as our critics, Katie and others, hold lively and sometimes heated debates about the works that they're reading and that hopefully you're reading with them. In the latest episode, Katie and her interlocutors discuss Manhattan Beach by Jennifer Egan. Check it out. Here at Working, we also love to hear from you by email. You can write to us via working@slate.com. You can also listen to past episodes at slate.com/working. This episode was produced and edited by Benjamin Frisch.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.